So it's great to be here. I studied development economics right here in Cambridge a few years ago, so it's always good to be back. But I am now the lead economist at the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development, or CAFOD, based in the UK. My name is Maria Finity. And so in my role at CAFOD, I look at how we need to reform the global financial system in order to make it more meaningfully pro-development, and how we can reform the aspects of the global financial system as it currently exists that are, in effect, actively obstructing development in many ways. And given that it's a jubilee year in the Catholic Church and the tradition of debt forgiveness, debt cancellation and jubilee that's been mentioned today, my focus, CAFOD's focus, and the Vatican's focus and many Catholic actors around the world are focusing on debt, global debt justice this year. So I'm going to start off with some broader kind of political context. I think we're at a really fascinating and pivotal moment in development economics right now and development more broadly. The consensus around aid and development that's dominated for the past half a century has really crumbled quite rapidly and quite dramatically in just the last 6 months. And we're now looking at a Labour government here in the UK. Labour, of course, being the party that created DFID, that enshrined 0.7 aid spending into law, now slashing aid spending and proclaiming that, to quote the new development minister, Britain is no longer a charity. So we're at this really interesting moment. The government are talking about modernising their approach to development and being investors and no longer being donors. So there's a huge opportunity here to rethink how countries like the UK do development. And I think there is a lot of cause for hope. And I think one of the reasons that we have cause for hope is there's an increasing acknowledgement in the development sector that the global financial system is not fit for purpose, that it obstructs development for the world's poorest countries. We're seeing acknowledgement of the fact that the power balance within the institutions that govern the global finance are representative of a kind of post-Second World War world, not representative of the world as it is today. We are seeing acknowledgement of the fact that the debt and tax systems are woefully insufficient and are creating crises and inequality and instability, and that sufficient action on the climate crisis under the current system is extremely difficult. And crucially, it's being recognised and highlighted that net financial flows are actually going from the lowest income countries to the highest income countries, aid or no aid. Until we reverse those financial flows, we will not see widespread development across the global south. We will not see a more equal world. So when I moved from parliamentary politics into the development sector around 6 years ago, these conversations around structural reform were very fringe, but now they're absolutely in the mainstream. Every single UN, IMF, World Bank, G20 summit is talking about these structural issues. Keir Starmer went to the UN General Assembly last year and said, we must fix the global financial system so that it works better for low-income countries. So that these arguments are really breaking through and turning into meaningful initiatives like Bridgetown, and the conversation has changed. But this agenda is also facing enormous political challenges. So far, what we're seeing in response to the election of Trump is a lowering of ambition across the board among other Western countries. Governments like the UK and many EU governments as well are using the Trump administration as an excuse not to pursue progressive reforms of the global financial system. And so the argument of the Jubilee campaign this year is that this is an opportunity for governments like the UK's to draw up a radical new agenda for reforming the global financial system that traps countries in poverty and leaves them reliant on aid in the first place, which could transform global development prospects without, crucially, without costing the UK Treasury a single penny. So it doesn't even run into Rachel Reeves's kind of infamous fiscal rules. But in many cases, this is not what's being pursued. In the wake of huge aid cuts, governments are actually focusing their energy on mobilising private finance for development. They're kind of shrugging their shoulders saying, well, sorry, there's no public money, so we're going to have to rely entirely on the private sector in order to pursue development and climate goals. And this is likely to involve reducing regulations on private investment. We've seen Macron calling for the deregulation of financial firms, removing human and environmental rights conditions. And I was at the IMF World Bank spring meetings in Washington a few months ago, and Rachel Reeves was sat on a panel with the head of the IMF saying the road to global growth is via deregulating the financial sector. We actually went too far. We got carried away after 2008. We implemented too many regulations. We need to get rid of them all. And that's what's going to produce global growth. But that's really what we're up against at this point. And we've experimented with mobilizing private finance for development for decades. It hasn't produced long-term sustainable development. In fact, in the absence of robust capital account management, it's actually destabilized a lot of vulnerable economies through speculative hot financial flows and other things. So the evidence that private investment in low-income and climate-vulnerable countries necessarily equals growth, which necessarily equals achieving the sustainable development goals, the evidence is just simply not there. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary of that. So in this political context, I think there are two key arguments that we need to be making. The first is that if private investment is going to help us meet climate and development goals, and it could, then we need more, not less, regulation and robust conditions in place to make sure that this investment does no harm and actually aligns with state-led development strategies. And the second argument we need to be making is that if wealthy countries are unwilling to show solidarity by spending on aid, then they must take ambitious action to reform the global financial system so that countries can actually mobilize their own domestic resources. So that's the political context. I'm going to look in a bit more depth at one aspect of global financial governance that is broken, and that's debt governance. And I'm going to take debt as a case study because, in the words of the UN Secretary General, he said, no example of the international financial architecture's failure is more glaring than its handling of debt. And I think that's absolutely true. And also, it's a jubilee year in the Catholic Church. And thanks to the leadership of Pope Francis, faith organisations all over the world are focusing on debt justice this jubilee year. So the biblical concept of jubilee calls for periodic debt forgiveness to restore justice and human dignity. And that's what inspired the Jubilee 2000 debt campaign that many of you will remember. It was arguably the most successful campaign in the history of global civil society. It led to more than $130 billion of debt being cancelled for 36 low-income countries. But 25 years later, we're in another Jubilee year, we're facing a new global debt crisis. And while this debt cancellation was hugely impactful in the short term, there was a failure to reform the system that produces unsustainable debt in the first place. And that is really the focus of the Jubilee 2025 campaign, is really fixing those structural problems. So an overview of the debt crisis we're facing. It's arguably the worst global South debt crisis in history. More than 50 countries are in debt distress, many others on the brink, and 3.3 billion people, nearly half of the world's population, live in countries in which their governments spend more on servicing debts than they spend on health or education. And that's what they're spending on, just on interest, not even repaying the principal amounts that they borrowed, but just on interest. So it's really shocking. And the causes are many, but a few are, there's no central permanent debt governance framework. It simply doesn't exist. Instead, debt governance is very piecemeal and kind of fragmented. And the governance that does exist all exists in institutions that are overwhelmingly dominated by creditor countries and creditors, which has created an imbalance of power. And as a result, these institutions encourage low-income countries to prioritize paying creditors over investing in their own development. And that's created a vicious cycle whereby, without investing in development, countries can't grow their economies and escape debt. So they're trapped in this cycle for many years. I think in the last few years, two of the countries that have received IMF bailout packages are Ghana and Sri Lanka, both of whom it was their 18th IMF debt bailout package since they became independent countries. So something's broken here. You know, it's a cyclical process. And so in the absence of clear international rules for responsible lending and borrowing, there's no effective mechanism for resolving crises, and there's nothing to stop predatory private lenders from lending on onerous terms and refusing to offer relief. So I know I'm short on time. I'll try to be brief there. I could go on for another hour, but I won't, I promise. The debt landscape has changed dramatically since the debt crisis of the 90s, when most low-income country debt was owed to wealthy countries like the UK, who could bilaterally agree to offer debt relief. Now, the vast majority of debt is actually owed to profitable private lenders, so international banks, hedge funds, asset managers, and they're not accountable to anyone but their shareholders. So they're not coming to the table and negotiating in good faith and offering debt relief. So the entire negotiation process is being deadlocked. And this also skews incentives. Most of us are economists, we think about incentives a lot. If private lenders know that they will not be compelled to offer debt relief, then there is nothing to dissuade them from offering risky loans on onerous terms, very high interest rates to begin with. And then there are also issues around often the IMF will come in when a country is in crisis, offer a bailout package that is then used to pay off private lenders. So that also skews the incentive. They know that there's a backstop and that they can be paid off with public money, as often happens. So what are the solutions? Well, I'll close with the main solution because I know I don't have much time. So the key thing that we're working on, at least in the UK, is a piece of legislation, a debt justice law. So the UK arguably has more power than any other country in the world to fix this problem. Remarkably, more than 90% of the debts owed by low-income countries to private lenders are actually governed under English law, because of the role of the City of London as a global financial centre. Really staggering, more than 90%. And under English law, these private creditors are able to sue debt-distressed countries for the full amount they lent plus interest. And so the UK government could pass a piece of legislation that would compel private creditors to participate in good faith in debt restructuring alongside all other lenders. It would save the UK Treasury money because we would, at the moment, we're offering debt relief, private creditors aren't, and we're effectively subsidising risky lending by private creditors. And it would fix the incentives in the system. And I'll just end with a case study that has been quite shocking. So just last month, the UK High Court ordered South Sudan to pay $657 million to a for-profit bank. And South Sudan is, you know, one of the poorest and most fragile states in the world. 70% of its population are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. And $657 million is almost 50% of the government's annual revenue. So this is one of the poorest countries in the world being ordered by an English court to pay half of its government's annual revenue to a for-profit bank. The UK government can act to change this tomorrow if it wants. Thank you.
Good question. You've got one.
Yes, actually, I have two short questions. Number one, I understand that there is a Jubilee law in the Bible. It's actually not just in the Bible, in a lot of ancient empires. That was a political practice. But in the Bible, the debt is an issue between a private lender and a private borrower. And I wonder how well you can translate a debt contract between two private individuals to the relationship between the national government and a bunch of private lenders, or a national government and another national government. Because the structure of agents is completely different from what is in the Jubilee law. And my second question relates to that. Why doesn't South Sudan simply go bankrupt, period? What's the point of all this talk about restructuring if we have a market mechanism that allows us to get rid of the debt? It's called bankruptcy. Mm-hmm.
Sovereigns can't go bankrupt.
Yes, there is no sovereign bankruptcy.
Sovereigns can't go bankrupt.
Should I come in or do you want to?
Are you okay to gather a few questions?
Yeah, that's fine.
I think I wouldn't disagree with anything you said, but there is an increasing role for remittances And the statistics show that remittances from diaspora populations far outweighs aid transfers. And I think this is the new future. I'm not against aid, you know. I think all countries at some time need aid in their history. But I think the emphasis is shifting much more to remittances, part because of migration. You know, people migrate to other countries and they want to support their host countries. The challenge really is to structure these remittances into meaningful investments in the receiving country. And that's a big challenge because often the remittances are private, family within families, that kind of thing. There has been a suggestion to develop what we call diaspora bonds. I don't know if they've actually been tried anywhere, but that was the Commonwealth was going to look at that a few years ago.
Okay.
That's a separate point. Let's look.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation. In terms of your discussion regarding English law, I think that could also be part of the problem. So even if your legislation went through, the private creditors still have a fiduciary duty to their investors. And these investors tend to be pension funds, which could be public pension funds and private pension funds. And so even if the legislation went through, I'm not sure in a court of law if that would override necessarily the fiduciary duty. And not only that, but even if it